This is Sounding Board Parenting, creating healthier human connections through the commonality of parenting, exploring the world of parenting with high-performing mums and dads from a range of backgrounds, industries, and family dynamics.
He said, the whole world looks different.
You can do it your way.
My life has been fundamentally altered by their existence.
I gotta tell you, kids don't stop learning.
That is how I change the story.
Babies are instant community generators.
My growth curve just like shot up after I had a kid.
I wasn't planning any of it.
Let's jump in 3, 2, 1.
This week's guest, we are absolutely chuffed to have on the Sounding Board Parenting Podcast. His name is Michael Crosland. And for a person that had spent almost a quarter of his life in hospital, he has achieved and accomplished so much, and he's having a massive impact, and I'm sure he will into the future as well. He's an inspirational speaker who has impacted millions of people. He shared the stage with the likes of Sir Richard Branson, Tony Robbins, and even the Dalai Lama as well, which I think is huge. So we'll definitely jump into that. He's also represented Australia at the sporting stage. He's a best-selling author of a book called Kids Don't Get Cancer, which I read recently, which I definitely recommend. And the most important thing to us here at Sounding Board Parenting, he is also a parent, which is absolutely awesome to us as well. Michael, it is awesome to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, mate. You pumped the tires up, so hopefully I can live up to the expectation. But I'm pumped to be here and grateful for the opportunity to have a chat with you today.
I'm really looking forward to it, And I suppose to get started, we always like our guests just to be able to introduce themselves a little bit. So just tell us a bit about yourself and the names and ages of your children too.
So I live on a beautiful part of the world called Coffs Harbour, Sawtelle actually, right on the coast. I live here with my beautiful wife. We've been married about 8 years. My journey began when I was 11 months old. I was diagnosed with an incurable cancer of the central nervous system. I'm sure we'll delve into that today. It's been a very, very long battle. Spent a lot of my life in hospital. I was a part of a trial drug. They trialed on 25 patients, and unfortunately 24 of them died. But I've been able to achieve some really great things. I've been very blessed to lead a wonderful life. I'm very grateful that I'm still here. And I'm the father of 41 children. 40 of them are at my orphanage in Haiti. They're aged between 4 and 17. And I am a very, very proud father of our miracle child, Lachlan James, who I know we'll get into in depth today. But he is, he's 2.5 years of age. And as I said before we started today, he certainly brought me the most incredible amount of pain that I've ever experienced in my life. I finally got a chance to walk a couple of months in my mum's shoes to feel the pain that she felt. But he has also brought me the most incredible joy that any person on this planet could ever ask for. And it's like another little human running around with my heart in his body. So I'm just forever grateful and forever blessed with what he has already taught me in his very short 2.5 years on this earth.
I can really feel that gratitude coming through, man. That is epic. And and it's even cooler. We've got something in common. My son Oscar, my partner Jess, and my son Oscar, who's 2.5 as well. So
there you go.
That's cool. Really cool. Yeah. Two little blondies as well. He's taken after his mum Jess as well. So he got lucky in that way. But you touched on your mum as well, who. After I read that book of yours, my admiration for your mum just went through the roof, and I'd love to circle back to that. And before we do that, I'm interested to know, Michael, what roles do you feel like you currently play in life?
What roles do I play? Wow. I've been told that I play a lot of roles in inspiring people and leading people and guiding people and mentoring people. But, you know, I'm really humble. I'm so grateful. I'm a really down to earth Aussie bloke. You know, people rave on 180 odd flights last year, 22 countries, audiences of over 600,000 people live, you know, 60 to 70 million views on some of my videos, which is just crazy. But I just want to be the best version of myself every day. I want to continue to grow and learn and listen and observe situations. I want to make sure that my son has a role model and has somebody to look up to and inspire to learn from. And I just want to make sure that not only do I live into my legacy, but I also leave a legacy too. So I think they're some of the roles that I play. You know, I'm a coach, I'm a son, I'm a brother, and I'm a husband. But you know, without a doubt, the greatest gift that God has bestowed on me is the gift of being a father.
That is awesome, man. I definitely resonate with that. Before we move on, what's your wife's name, Michael?
Melissa.
Melissa. Awesome. Melissa, Lachlan, and Michael. How has parenting changed your life? Because you mentioned there it is one of the greatest gifts that's been bestowed upon you. I'd love to know a little bit more about how parenting has changed your life.
I think for a long time, my life was about me. It was about serving me and serving my needs and serving my desires and ensuring that I could grow myself into just a great version of myself. But now, you know, someone steals every single piece of your heart, and it's a remarkable experience. And for me, it was a real moment for my life to shift. You know, I spent many, many, many years in hospital. I realized when my son was sick that it's far easier to be lying in the bed than standing next to it. You know, I was a part of that trial drug back in 88, burnt me from head to toe. I was completely covered in blisters. They would wrap me up in bandages and they would lie me in baths full of ice trying to prevent my brain from frying. They trialed it on 25 patients and all of them besides myself died within 90 days. I thought I had it tough because I was experiencing the pain, but becoming a father, I realized that the pain that my mother felt, the pain that my father felt is what real pain is, because you're in a situation in your life where the person that you love more than anything in the world is the one person that you can't take their pain away from. And that is almost inhumane. That is extreme pain. And when our little boy was brought into the world 10 weeks early, only weighing 2 pounds and being told that we only had a week with him, and being told that he had sepsis, and watching a man resuscitate my little boy and praying above, saying, hey, take my house, take my career, take my followers, take everything that I have and own and have worked to achieve, but just please don't take my little boy. I think that's when a whole renewed perspective on what truly is important in your life becomes so paramount, and your perspective changes forever, and you start to be so grateful for the little things that you never thought you would be grateful for, like the air that we breathe, the sunshine that we feel. And I know that, you know, in life we must embrace the coolness of the shadows to truly enjoy the warmth of the sunshine. And I think it's not the adversity in our life that defines us, it's how we deal with it. And some of the most inspiring, influential people in the world are the people that have been grounded into the earth over and over again but just continue to get back up. And I think by becoming a father and having the challenges that we've had with our little boy, that has really redefined and reshaped and remolded the man that I am. And I'm so much better of a human being now than what I was before the challenges that we faced.
I'm getting a real sense of optimism coming through thick and fast, Michael, and it's something I picked up from the book as well, and it sounds like it's something that's been a big component of your life to date as well. Let's go back in time a little bit in terms of young Lachlan, and tell us about the story behind the moment you found out you were going to be a dad for the first time.
Oh. So we, for the listeners that haven't heard my story before, we were told that we'd never be able to have kids. And that's one of the contributing factors to why we opened an orphanage in Haiti So we have 100 and, or we did have 120 kids at our school. Now we have 270 kids at our school in Haiti. And then we opened an orphanage because I walked past this place and it was just dilapidated. It was after the earthquake, 316,000 people had died and it was horrific. I spoke to this one little boy. He said the best part about living in the orphanage is he gets a bowl of rice every second day. The worst part is he shares a bed of a nighttime with two little boys, and where he sleeps at the tarp over his bed and it rains, they get soaking wet because the tarp leaks, but he still gets wet whether it rains or not because both the boys still pee their pants. But his major appreciation in life was the fact that he gets a bowl of rice every other day. So we came back and we rebuilt the orphanage, and now we've got 40 beautiful little babies that we get to look after, and every one of them has their own bed. They have a roof over their head that doesn't leak. They all go to school. They're all getting an education. And they're realizing they can achieve some remarkable things. We've had a graduate from our school. He's gone on to go to university. He's he got a full ride scholarship to Brazil to study engineering. So it's amazing that through great pain and adversity, so much joy can be brought from that, the way we look at it and the way we deal with it. And as I'm sure we all know, that old saying, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. So we were just really happy to have our 40 little babies over there, and we tried to adopt some kids from Haiti, and unfortunately due to sex trafficking, they shut down all the adoption processes. So we went down the long process of IVF, and they told us that it was going to work. So we were just over the moon, and many, many, many years and hundreds of thousands of dollars, as you can all imagine, to try and get to the point where our child had cracked the 8-week mark. And we thought, okay, now things are looking good. Then we got the 12-week scan, and we just couldn't believe it. It was the most amazing experience. My wife surprised me with a box with like all these different colored confetti and a beautiful poem that our unborn child had written to me, you know, saying how amazing it was to have me as their dad. And then obviously the scary 29 week getting rushed to hospital down to Sydney, and 2 centimeters dilated and intensive care unit level 3 and all those sort of things was just insane. But what was amazing for me throughout that period of time, and even those days in hospital where they said he probably wasn't going to make it, it really instilled in me this belief that the quality of one's life is not dictated, nor is it determined by the amount of days that we live on this earth, but it's about what we fit into those days that allows us to live a remarkable life. And it's also that saying, you're never too old to learn, you're never too young to teach. And I think that, you know, in those first few weeks in ICU, he taught me so much about myself. He taught me so much about life. He taught me so much about love. Elder. It was a really tough time in our life, but it was just such a beautiful thing knowing that, you know, that I was going to be a dad. It was amazing.
I don't want to push any further, mate. I just want to acknowledge the vulnerability you're showing right now. You're stepping into that arena, as Brené Brown says, and I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for that too. And let's take a little left turn from that. Then I'm circling back to that though in a second. But you mentioned before Haiti, and that was huge. When I was reading about that in your book about the trek to get to where you needed to get to really start to build what is now this school, this orphanage, I think was awesome in itself. And the way you wrote that really spoke to me, and now that I've talked to a few other people that have read it too, it sounds like that's a common thread for those reading. I'm interested to know, in the book you talk about a moment in Haiti when you see, I think you said, a 9-year-old boy run out of a store of some sort with a loaf of bread, I think it was, and unfortunately a security guard of some sort shot the young boy. What was that like for you to one, see that, and this is a two-part question, what was it like to experience that, to see that, and then to probably flow on from that, What challenges do you see from a parenting point of view in a place like Haiti compared to a place like Australia where we live?
I think the greatest learning from that moment in my life was perspective. And it would be very easy for me to get frustrated with people that complain about their first world problems. Or it's a moment in time where I can be so grateful that first world problems don't cause me the pain, anxiety, and frustration that it causes so many. And I think that was a very heartbreaking reality of what people face day in, day out in different places around the world. And I think to myself, you imagine being in a world where you just need to survive. That's it. That's what you need to do. You don't care about the pain that you cause others. You don't care about the hatred that you instill in the world. It's just literally trying to survive. And I think to myself, you know, now being a father, I would absolutely do anything for my boy, anything. You know, if they said that he needed a new heart and there was some way that my heart would fit, I'd be out, you know, no question. He would have my heart tomorrow so he could lead a better life. And I just think, you imagine when you've got, you know, millions of people, 80% of the population, 8 million people out of an island that has 10 million people on it, that is one third the size of Tasmania, who are unemployed. You've got no income. You've got no roof over your head. You're disappointed with yourself as a parent because you can't provide for the kids that you love more than anything in the world. And you'll do absolutely anything to just try and help them survive. I think your behavior and what you do day in, day out would be significantly different than if you had a 9-to-5, clearly. And I think, again, I just constantly reflect on how much gratitude I have, the fact that I've been brought up into a world that is full of choices and is full of freedom. And right now, some of our freedom is being taken away from us. And that is causing a lot of anger and a lot of frustration towards people around the world. And I think that there are people in their life that have had no freedom their entire life. So I think that it's, again, that whole notion of embrace the coolness of the shadows, embrace the challenges that the world is throwing at us right now, so that when we get through these challenges, we will actually be able to really enjoy the ray of sunshine so much more. And I think the disparity or the differences between trying to raise a child in Haiti and raising a child here, fundamentally, at the end of the day, we just want to bring joy and happiness into their life. And, you know, I really believe that there are the 3 P's and the 3 L's when it comes to parenting. The 3 P's, we must be patient, we must be persistent, and we must instill perspective into our children's hearts. I think that they are so important for us to be successful parents or parents of influence, is to demonstrate patience constantly, you know. And I reflect back to the analogy of when my son was trying to walk, you know, if every time he tried to walk, I tried to speed him up because I had no patience and I just picked him up, then he would never learn to walk. Every time he made a mess trying to eat his Weet-Bix and banana of the morning and it goes all over him and all over the floor, and that frustrates me, but I need to show patience and allow him to demonstrate persistence in acting upon this simple task of feeding himself. And now he's 2.5 years of age and he can feed himself, and it's amazing because we can get his breakfast ready and we can go and get stuff done, and he sits there and eats his Weet-Bix and reads a book or plays with a toy or watches TV. That's off the back of being patient and being persistent. And then to demonstrate perspective into our children's lives as they grow up, to realize that they have been brought up into a world where they have freedom, where they have choices, where they have healthcare, where they have a roof over their head, where they have food in their tummies. You know, I think to implement those 3 P's are remarkable. And then from a parenting point of view as well, the 3 L's, you know, if we can demonstrate and show and make our kids feel loved, I think we need to demonstrate and show that our kids need to have limits. And then to, you know, make sure that we have lots of laughter. You know, if we show love, limits, and laughter, we show power, patience, persistence, and perspective. I think there's some really great things that we as parents must implement into our children's lives so that they can be the best versions of themselves, but also for them to look to us to say, you know what, you know, our parents have given us guidance and assurance and a safety net and the love and the nurturing that we certainly need, because there are a lot of kids in this world that don't have parents that demonstrate those traits, and they go down the wrong path and then wonder why they make really bad choices in the future.
That is epic, Michael. Just you're talking some real fundamentals there, I think, as well. And there's a couple of things that come to mind for me when you mentioned those. The first was the reference to there's no rushing along a toddler or a young one that's trying to walk. And that's one of the beautiful lessons that Oscar has taught me, and I consider him to be my greatest teacher in a lot of ways. They are great at really forcing you to stop and smell the roses, I think, because we are in this rush day to day, that 9 to 5 sort of panic, getting from meeting to meeting, just everything needs to be done now. You're not going to force a 2-year-old to come up to your pace. So you need to come back to their pace. And when you do, well, this is my experience anyway, when you do, everything is so much more alive. I feel more alive. I see the aliveness in nature, in the trees, in the sky, because that's what they're living day to day. And I totally agree. If we can model more of that as our approach, and just on what you mentioned around the 3 P's and 3 L's, at the end of the day, for you to get to that point of thinking that would be beneficial for young Lachlan, that means you're going to have to practice it too, which you're going to see the benefits individually. And that's something I've thought a lot about, and we believe strongly in at Sounding Board Parenting, is if you want to be the best parent you can be, you have to become a better person first and keep working on that.
Yeah. And I think the best way to learn is to teach, right? And we're teaching our children a certain type of behavior, and that implements into our behavior as well. And that sort of drives our intention every morning. And it's amazing. Yesterday I was down watching the sun go down with my little boy. It was just a really special moment with him. And I was watching this father and his son, and they were down the beach a little bit and they were fishing. And he was maybe 9 or 10 years old, and he threw the line out and his dad was on his phone and playing with his rod or something. And then his son's like, "Hey dad, I've got a fish." And the dad was like, yeah, all right, whatever. And then he's like, no, I've really got a fish. And I'm looking over and this rod's bending and he's trying to wind it in, and his face was lit up and he was so excited, even though his dad was showing zero attention. And then all of a sudden the dad sees that he's on a fish, and the dad runs over and the little boy is just so excited, you know, he's got this fish and he's so pumped. And his dad just comes over, takes the fishing rod off him and winds the fish in. And the little boy just sits back and he's just like he was completely... And I was like, the child will never learn. Like, we need to, if the fish falls off, then that's a really powerful lesson. And as we all know, we learn far more from a loss than we do from a win. So give the kid a chance to fail. But, you know, and I put up a post a little while back. And as you know, I know you follow me on social media, and I'm very fortunate to have some really great people that support me and follow me on social. But I put up a picture of a dad who was just staring at his phone, and there was this little boy trying to talk to his dad, and the caption was something along the lines of, "I wish I was in daddy's phone, I'd finally get some attention." You know, I really delved into that a lot, and I just make a commitment that my son never sees me on my phone. I don't want him to see. I've got an office. I try and go into the office and shut the door. I don't want him to see that my phone is important, because if he perceives that the phone's more important than he is, then, you know, that's not a great way to grow up.
Yeah, that resonates in a big way. What is yours and Melissa's approach to technology with young Lachlan? So I think that's one slice of that pie. I'm really interested in to expand on that too, because it's something that's so prominent nowadays, and it's something that, I mean, is going to have to be embraced one way or another. What is your approach to it? What's your thoughts on technology?
My thoughts are, technology nowadays is used as a babysitter to prevent parents from having to parent. And I know that might tick some people off, because I understand that Sometimes an iPad at a restaurant can enable mum and dad to have a beautiful dinner whilst the son or the daughter is no longer screaming and yelling and bringing the house down. But, you know, my son doesn't have an iPad. He doesn't play games. I would prefer him to be outside jumping on the trampoline or, you know, running around with the rake. He loves running around with the rake at the moment, which is kind of cool because there's lots of leaves on the ground. So he's loving that, you know.
Win-win.
But it's really about a balance, right? I really think it's important. I need to make sure that he knows how to use technology, because fundamentally that is how the world is changing, and we need to evolve and adapt and embrace change like everybody else is. And he will get further and further behind if he's not up to speed with those sort of things. Like my nephews, they're just like full-time gamers. That's it. I can go to their house and I won't even see them. They won't come outside of their bedroom. And I think from a parenting point of view, that needs to be an adjustment. You know, you can play a certain amount of games, but when there's people here, you need to acknowledge them. You need to stop. You need to come out. You need to say good day. And I really love the philosophy of the one charge process. You know, you've got one charge a week. So if you've got an iPad and you like to play games on it, you've got one charge a week. And I'm definitely going to implement that with my son when the time is right. And we will do the study on a Sunday night when it gets charged to let him know what the weather forecast looks like. And it looks like it's going to be raining on Tuesday and Thursday. So make sure you're not playing on your iPad Monday and Wednesday, because it's sunny those days and you get a chance to go outside. But use it on Tuesdays and Thursday when it's raining, because there's going to be nothing to do outside. So, you know, that's sort of my approach. Like everything, we need to get a really good balance. And I'm hoping that I can do that the best I can. You know, and I'm sure there's going to be times when he's going crazy, he's yelling, screaming the house down. I'm like, here, I have my phone, just have a play. But I'm hoping that I can really demonstrate that patience and that persistence to give him a really good shot at being a great human being.
You've put some real conscious thought into parenting, haven't you, Michael?
Oh, when someone tells you your entire life that you're not going to be able to do something, you have a choice. You have a choice to listen to it, believe it, and accept. Or you have the choice to say, you can say what you want to say, but no one in your life is ever going to tell you what you can do. They'll only ever tell you what you can't do. So I've been given a remarkable gift to become a dad. And my dad taught me beautifully how not to be a dad. He taught me beautifully how not to be a husband. And I think so often in life, we strive to admire people's behavior and replicate them in our life. But sometimes we need to admire the bad or the poor choices that people make to ensure that we don't implement those behaviors in our life. So I'm a better man because of the lessons that I learned from somebody that didn't demonstrate the right traits that I believed in. And I want to make sure that I give that feeling to my son of safety and love and comfort, and to make sure that he knows that his daddy loves him regardless, and that I'm incredibly proud of him to get up every day and call me his daddy.
The fact that you have been able to, what I would call, go full circle and get to a place of gratitude of potential shortcomings or whatever they may be to you of your parents, of your dad that you just mentioned, I think is epic. And yeah, and I think that is quite rare out there, just from what I have seen in the community and society in general in my circles. So just to see that, like, and I can see how authentic that is. That is really cool. And let's take a deeper dive into that, if you're open to it, Michael. In terms of the parenting that you experienced as a child, what was it like?
Time for a short reflection break. This is an opportunity for you to stop, take a breath, and reflect on your past week as a parent. If you have a pen and paper near you, that's great. If not, simply use your phone or laptop. I want you to write down three things. First, write down one moment in the past week that you were proud of yourself as a parent. Second, write down one area of your parenting that you would like to improve for the next week. Third, Write down one moment from the past week where your child or children have made you smile. Be kind to yourself and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Well, back to your point, I really think that there are only two types of people in the world. There are those that use their pain and suffering as the justification behind why they choose to fail in their life. And there are those who use the exact same pain and suffering, sometimes much worse pain and suffering, as the motivation to succeed. And it's just about making that choice to shift your mindset and choose to live the life that you want to live. And I chose not to live the life that I did growing up. And I want to make the conscious decision to ensure that my family don't lead that life. You know, when I grew up, it was tough. It was very, very much week to week. My mum and I were away at hospital for literally months and months and months at a time. And that's hard on my father and my three older sisters to get through. And I don't doubt it would have been horrifically challenging as a father to have your one and only son 6 hours south or 10 hours on a train ride, because we couldn't afford a plane or a car, to come down and visit me, and to have a Friday afternoon waiting for your blood test to come back to see if you've got enough white cells to be able to get on the train and get home at midnight on 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning, to then stay there for basically 24 hours and then get on the train at midnight or 11 o'clock on Sunday night to get back to hospital at 8 a.m. in Sydney on the Monday morning so I can have my chemo at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, like an hour after I get off the train. So that would have been really tough. You know, that would have been really challenging. So I really wanted to make sure that for my son, that he financially didn't have to struggle. So, you know, I've worked very, very hard. As you know, I've sacrificed a lot to be able to achieve some really cool things in my life, which I'm very proud of. And I want to make sure that my son feels nurtured and feels loved and certainly feels very, very safe. You know, I've never touched alcohol, which has been a really big win for my family. There's never been any drugs that has been consumed, and that stomps out a lot of violence and a lot of fear. And that's really the path that I wanted to lead my life down. And I think that's going to have a remarkable shift in the generation of the Crosslands moving forward.
You mentioned there just some of those experiences that you had in hospital and that you had with your mum. I'd like to talk about Nurse Jo, because she's someone that stood out to me in your book. And the reason I want to talk about the role that she played in your life and plays in your life is because I'm interested in the importance you place on support networks for parents. Do you guys have a support network around you with Lachlan? How does that work? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, great point. And Nurse Jo is amazing. For those that haven't read the book, Nurse Jo was obviously my nurse when I was having chemo. We lived at Ronald McDonald House for nearly 2 years before the relationship went to the next level with Jo. And she said, you know what, we would love to have you come and stay with us rather than at Ronald McDonald House. So my mum and I moved into my nurse's house, and we lived there for many years, off and on through treatment and post-treatment. And now I'm 36 years of age and I still have to go to Sydney for my tests regularly. And I still stay with my nurse, Jo, after all these years. In fact, I'm the godfather of her two kids. So that is really, really special for me. And it's funny because she only wrote on Facebook last night. I hadn't heard from her in a while. She's like, hey, when are you sending me a copy of your new book? So that was, she gave me a little stab. So she's always there for me. Even, you know, for those that don't know, I had bacterial meningitis about 8-9 years ago, had fluid on the brain. Then 4 years ago, I got diagnosed again with 4 more tumors in my throat, which was, you know, a really challenging and really scary time for me. And she was there. She packed up from Sydney and she got in a car and she drove to Newcastle, and then she drove up to Coffs Harbour and she drove to wherever the hospital was that I'm at, so she could be by my side, which is just really special. So fundamentally for us, you know, support network is key and critical. I always think that it is not a sign of weakness, but rather a sign of strength when we put our hand up and say, hey, I need some help. So we have a really good counselor that we regularly speak to, a part of our marriage, you know, because we want to make sure that that fundamentally is incredibly strong, because that is a really beautiful foundation for a child to have loving parents. And so that's really, really key for us. Our little boy has godparents, which they're just really great role models. You know, we admire them as human beings. We admire what they stand for and how they are as parents and how they demonstrate and be such a great role model for our little boy. So, you know, we love them dearly. And, you know, we're very selective with the people that we spend our time with. And I think that's really important. For a long time, as I was growing through the corporate world and as the ego got elevated a lot when it come to speaking, and you're up on stage in front of 20,000 people and you think it's important to have thousands of friends. And, you know, we did a declutter in January of this year where we decluttered our network, you know, our friendship. We cleaned up our cupboard and we cleaned up our friends, and we wanted to make sure that, are they growing us? Are they stretching us? Is it a two-way investment? Are we growing them and are they growing us? Are they challenging us to make sure that we're better people and vice versa? And I think that's really important, that whole quantity versus quality, that for us has been a real key.
That's awesome. We mentioned Tony Robbins at the start of the podcast, and I think he talks about that exact situation is the power of proximity in terms of being selective on who you are spending time with. And that's something that's been a real game changer for me personally. So to hear it from yourself is even cooler, Michael, because I think in terms of, those associations that you choose to have plays a really important role, and then that physical environment that you're creating for yourself. So literally cleaning out the cupboard or just creating the space or the spaces that allow you to be your best self. And I mentioned before I'd give you a little bit of time, but we would circle back to it. So I think I've given you enough time now, but I'd love to learn a bit more about, from your point of view, what have you learnt from young Lachlan? What has he taught you?
Well, to almost phrase back to what you were saying before, and now this question, you know, I've learned over the last few years that your value does not decrease based on one's inability to see your worth. I think that's been a really big win for me. You know, I think we strive so hard in this world to prove to other people our worth. And at the end of the day, you can be of great value and great service and have a global impact and still lie in bed at night time and not be happy with yourself. And I think that needs to come first. You know, you need to be happy in your own skin. You need to love yourself. You need to value yourself. You need to invest in yourself. And you need to know that you continually strive daily to be the best version of yourself. And for me, that's, I think, a really powerful lesson that my little boy has taught me. You know, he is without a doubt the best friend that he's the best friend that I've ever had in my life, you know, and he is my why. He gets me out of bed when my health tells me I probably should stay in bed. You know, he continually makes me fight and strive to be a better man and a better husband and a better father. And it's just, you know, I've been constantly in my life, due to my health, being given an end date. And, you know, it was funny because many years ago, or even 2016, when I was sick, I was almost at that point where I'm like, you know what, I've been able to achieve some great things. I've been able to impact a lot of people around the world. And when my time's up, it's up. But now I have a little boy, and the whole, like, the whole outlook on life has completely changed. And, you know, I don't want my time to be up. You know, I want to be there at my son's first soccer game. You know, I want to be there when he graduates high school. I want to be there when he falls in love and when he's heartbroken, and to help him mend that heart. I want to be there when he gets married, and, you know, all those things that change when your heart quadruples in size because you have been given a gift of a child that you thought you would never, ever be able to receive.
Taking a pause there.
I'll take a drink.
Yeah, and I thought we'd just take a pause for our listeners out there too. I think we've definitely broken through a few layers of intimacy here in terms of connection and just, yeah, what we're diving into. So
I gotta say, I get asked to do podcasts every single day, and I do them as much as I can when I have time. That whole saying, if it's important, you'll find a way. If not, you'll find an excuse. You were very persistent in asking me to get on your podcast, and I didn't know that we were going to delve as deep as what we did, because so often it's just share your story, tell me about your cancer battles, tell me about your baseball, tell me about your corporate life, tell me about sharing the stage with the Dalai Lama and, you know, and Richard Branson. Today's been about real stuff, you know, about life, about love, you know, about what's really important, more so than ever before, the way the world is right now. So it's it's great to have this chat.
I'm really appreciative, and that persistence. I don't know. You just know sometimes. You know when to really follow something and be persistent, because your gut, your intuition is just telling you, is pulling you towards it. And I knew something like this was in store. So I just want to acknowledge you again for jumping on, but also, yeah, just being so authentic as well. It's something that's really refreshing to me, and I'm sure it is to a lot of other people out there too. So thank you, Michael.
Pleasure.
And just starting to get to the end of our time together, which I could just go on for hours, but but with you mentioned before, or you actually mentioned in the book, this is something I'd love to ask you. You mentioned you love the thought of giving to those that could never repay you. And you mentioned it towards the end of the book, and that really stuck with me. And I've been even just writing it down while I'm journaling each day, just writing something like that down, just to really sort of give it some conscious thought. Mm-hmm. And I've got a few thoughts about it, but I'm interested to know what does that mean to you, and why do you want to give to those that cannot repay you for that?
I always thought the saying was, the more you give, the more you shall receive. But I think the saying should be, the more you give expecting nothing in return, the more you shall receive. And something that I talk a lot about in the new book is the notion of, we must give without remembering and receive without forgetting. And, you know, something very simple that I do every morning, and those that follow me on Instagram will see it, because every now and then I throw it up, but my elderly neighbor, he's 84 years of age, he needs a walking stick to get the mail out of the mailbox. And the guy on the bike, he throws the paper every morning early. And I go for a run about 5:30. I need to get back into the house before the world wakes up, because I have a low immune system, so I can't be out and about. So when I walk up my driveway, I see that the newspaper is quite a long distance from his front door. So he has to walk around his garden and grab, you know, with his walking stick to try and get the paper. And I simply just grab the paper and I just lob it onto his front porch. He never knows that it's me. He thinks that the paper boy has got an epic aim and seems to land it on his front door every single morning. I don't do that because I want him to say thank you. I do it just because I know it's making an impact. For a long time, I used to go and pay for my petrol, for example, and then I'd pay for somebody petrol at Bowser 6. I never pay for their diesel because it's usually like over $100 and I don't want to do that, right? So I pay for whatever Bowser it is. And for a long time, I'd get in my car and I'd just wait for the person to go inside to pay for the fuel. And then they'd pay for the fuel and or they'd go and try and pay for the fuel and the person behind the counter and say, oh, that guy out there in the car, he paid for your fuel. And they'd look at you and they'd be like, oh, thank you so much. And then you go, no problem. And then you drive off. And then I realized the only reason why I was paying for that fuel is because I wanted to be thanked. I was only doing something to get something in return from another person. And I realized that you get a release of serotonin, you get a release of whatever it is, endorphins, you get the good hit, the helper's high, when you make a difference in somebody else's life. That needs to be enough. It's not about getting a pat on the back. You know, I mowed my neighbor's lawn one day and then she came over and asked me whether I mowed her lawns and I said no. And then like 2 weeks later, I drove up the street. My neighbor is mowing a lady's lawn like six doors down. And then she came and knocked on my door because she thought that I mowed her lawns. And she said, did you mow my lawns? And I got to tell you, half of me wanted to say yes. Because if I told her that I mowed her lawns, she'd mow my lawns and I didn't even mow her lawns. And 6 weeks later, I come up my street and somebody had mowed my lawns. I had no idea who that was. That was 9 years ago. People are still mowing each other's lawns randomly in my street. I don't mow anybody's lawn anymore, yet every now and then my lawns get mowed. So it's not about service for getting something in return. It's purely about service to make an impact. It's about giving without remembering. It's ensuring that when we do receive, we never forget, and we make sure that we strive every day simply to identify somebody in some way that we can help assist their life and make their life better for no other reason but to help make somebody else's life better.
Paying it forward in a big way by the sounds of it around the community. That's awesome. Just on the point you made about giving and not expecting anything in return, it's something that even from a coaching point of view, I see in different clients or just in the community that can be a real struggle point. And I've struggled with that in the past as well, just in terms of what you were talking about. And something that's become really clear for me lately through coaching is that whenever we are trying to create change in one area of our lives, overall in our lives, we tend to, early on expect people to notice the progress that we're making, but it usually doesn't work out like that. The progress doesn't really get noticed by the external, by those other people for a long time. So I've started working with people on creating little processes, little systems of celebrating themselves, their own progress. So yeah, by giving and not expecting anything in return, I totally agree that gives you that natural high and something that whether it should be enough or not, I'm not sure of, but being able to celebrate yourself, I don't think that's done enough in life in general. We don't celebrate our own progress enough. We expect our self-worth is usually determined by the external, which is really unfortunate in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that it's so important that we're growing and investing in ourselves, not for other people to acknowledge it or notice it. It's for us to just be a better version of ourselves, you know, so that we can lie in bed of a night time and know that we are living the life that we have been set on this earth to live. And, you know, that whole giving notion, I've done it before in the past where I've opened the door for somebody and they just walk through and I'm like, you're welcome. You know, I'm like, well, hang on a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. A, they didn't ask me to open the door. And B, if I was truly congruent with my passion to give other people and expect nothing in return, I would not expect a thank you. So stop expecting your good deeds to be acknowledged and noticed. What they are being noticed and acknowledged in is your subconscious mind. And when you get that subconscious mind working in the way that you need for it to work so that you feel good about yourself, then the return on your investment is no longer a prerequisite to your giving. And I think that is really important.
That is epic. Let's, before we wrap up, we've got a little bit more time and I want to talk about your new book, Everything Will Be Okay. But before we do that, I always like to ask this one, and that's if you could transport back in time with one piece of advice for your pre-parent self, what would that piece of advice be, Michael?
Oh dear. It won't be anywhere near as easy as what you think it will be, but I assure you it will be worth it. That's probably it. I thought it was going to be just a breeze and lots of fun, and people told me it was going to be difficult, but yeah, sure. Oh my God, it's been so much harder than what I ever anticipated and thought, but I'm just so grateful for the lessons. I'm such a better person because of it, and the joy and the happiness and the love certainly outweighs the frustration and mess that is regularly seen every morning when you step on some blocks on the lounge or something that you didn't expect to be there.
that minuscule Lego piece that's
exactly.
you'd be all about the Lego, wouldn't you? Camp quality, there's some correlation there.
There is a big connection.
Oh wow, we could go into a whole nother episode on that topic, I think. But what are you loving about parenting right now, Michael?
Well, I usually am away about 8 months a year, and I've been in isolation for 15 weeks. So I'm loving right now the fact that I get up, I go work out, I meditate, I do my gratitude journal all before my son wakes up, and then I get an opportunity to be truly present with him. To hear him say, "Daddy, I'm awake," and to walk in there and to see that little boy's face just unbelievably light up every single morning, and then to be able to cuddle him over nighttime and have that set routine that we have where we walk into his room and he says, "Shut the door," and then he says, "Sit down," and then he says, "Put the blanket on," and then he says, "Blanket off," and then he says, "Bedtime now," you know, like that is just, they're the little things that we take for granted, the things that I've never been able to actually enjoy. Like I've sung happy birthday to my boy via Skype, you know, I've had to give him a kiss through the phone months at a time, and that's tough. So to be able to be with him every single day, to, you know, I took him to daycare today and I'm like, you know, if it wasn't for me doing this podcast, I probably would have taken him a little later so I could have just hung out with him a little bit longer and maybe dropped him off at lunchtime so I could go and catch up with the boys down the beach for, you know, whatever it was. You know, it's just crazy how your priorities change, and I'm just I'm pumped for that.
Man, that lights me up. And I've heard that a lot through this period, in terms of people really sort of gaining clarity on what matters most to them. Mm. And it sounds like it's something that has mattered to you for a long time. But I just felt a little bit of emotion come on when you mentioned that the words that he says, because it's something I experience as well, and it just lights you up just hearing those words, like lights me up more than anything in the world, which is beautiful, and I'm so grateful to experience that, and I'm really grateful for the time that you've taken, Michael, and we always finish with a segment called Time to Plug Off, and I really want to be able to have a chat about really where can I and listeners find what you're up to, but also to find a little bit more about your next book, Everything Will Be Okay.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm on every social media channel you can imagine. So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, whatever it is, I'm on it. So please jump by and say good day and check in with me. That'd be amazing. And the new book, yeah, Everything Will Be Okay. It's a remake of my old book, plus an extra 50,000 words around what's happened from 2015 all the way through to now, which is, as you know, has been an absolute roller coaster of challenges, but also incredible joy as well. And the book title, you know, when I was 6 years old and we were finally allowed to go home, the doctor said, "Your son will never go to school. He'll never play sport. He'll be a housebound baby. And if he reaches his teenage years, it'll be a miracle." And Mum walked through the curtains and I made out I didn't hear what the doctor said. I said, "What did the doctor say?" And she said, "Oh, the doctors told me that everything will be okay." At the age of 12, when I had a heart attack after a tough couple of months in hospital, and they said that I would never play sport again, my mum came through the curtains. I said, "What did the doctor say?" And she said, oh, the doctors told me that everything will be okay. And as you know, a couple of years later, I was lucky enough to fly to America and play baseball and get a chance to live my dream over there. When I was, how old was I? 28. And I got bacterial meningitis, got fluid on the brain, that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to walk or talk. It was just, it was a really tough time. And again, my mum told me, the doctors told me that everything was going to be okay. And then 4 years ago, when I was diagnosed with four tumors of my throat, and they told me that that my tomorrows weren't guaranteed, my mum called me and she said, what did the doctor say? And I finally got a chance to return the favor. And I told her that everything was going to be okay. And then 2 years ago, when our little boy was sick, and they took me into a room and they sat me down and they said to me, we're terribly sorry, but we believe your little boy has an illness called sepsis. We don't think that he will make the end of the week. And I walked outside and my wife looked at me and she said, what did the doctor say? And I told her with a tear in my eye that everything was going to be okay. And then you go to the start of this year and COVID kicks in and I lose 68 events in one day. My whole year of income is gone out the window. My roadshow with Tony Robbins has been canceled. My wife comes home and she's lost her job. My mum rings me and tells me that she's lost her job. And my wife said to me, what are we going to do? And I told her that everything was going to be okay. And I decided to commit a few months to put pen to paper, to share what has happened and continues to happen in my life, but also to share the tools, the principles, the mindset that I really need to not just survive, but to thrive through these challenging times. And finally it's out. It arrived a couple of days ago, so I'm pretty jazzed with it. It's amazing what a bit of makeup does, and really good lighting and a bit of blurring from the photographer. But the book is out now, and I'm really proud of it. Obviously, all the profits from my book goes to charity because it's all about serving, not earning. And yeah, you can grab it from my website, michaelcrossland.com or Booktopia or Amazon or wherever you want to get it. But if you get it from my website, obviously I'll sign it before I send it out. But that's the big plug. I'm not much of a sales guy. I don't really do the big sales pitch, but that's the book, and I'd love for you to get a copy.
Well, I'm sold.
Very cool.
Michael, you're an absolute gem of a soul. This is something that that I'm already cherishing, spending the last hour with you, and yeah, everything from the angel of your mum to the stories of young Lachlan and everything in between. I really just want to send well wishes across to yourself, Melissa, and young Lachlan, and to the rest of those that you're close to as well. And I'm really looking forward to it at some point once these borders open, meeting yourself and your beautiful family in person. Thank you.
My pleasure, mate. Great to be on the show.
That was epic, man. Oh. You know, like, I mean, you coach and stuff, you know how like you go to events and or whatever it might be, and you vibrate that energy that everyone else is feeling, and you just cut through the surface layer. It happens every week, man, but this is special. Just really, really appreciate you jumping on.
My pleasure, mate. Thanks for being persistent and patient in making it happen. And I don't know whether you've seen, but I've got a fireside chat on Sunday night. Obviously, I'd love for you to grab a ticket and come to that.
Okay.
It's all via Zoom. It's on all my social media channels. And with that, by getting a ticket to the Zoom fireside chat, you get all my audio books for free. Oh, and you also get a copy of my book signed, a part of that deal. So, if you can jump on and grab one, it'd be obviously no force if you can't, but if you can, it'd be great to have you involved.
Oh, definitely. No, that's awesome, Michael. I'll follow up. Like this will probably come out towards the end of this month. We'll just get it produced, get the micro done and all the rest, but I'll make sure I shoot all that through to yourself as well. But on the side of that, like, is there anyone that comes to mind for you that you think would be cool to get on the podcast at some point. Anyone that you know of, I'm always curious to sort of create these connections through our podcast guests. So
yeah, let me give that some thought. I don't really know too many in that space that would be able to really add value.
Sure.
But I'll give it some thought. I know there's a guy in New Zealand, but he has a podcast very, very similar.
Yeah, cool.
So I don't know how that all would fit and work, but
if you got a name, I'm always interested in listening to some more as well. I'm a big podcast buff, so
I wish I could remember his name. I can just visualize his face, and he's very Kiwi. You almost need a translator to understand him, but he's a lovely fella.
Oh, if
I remember his name, I'm sure it'll pop up on Facebook one of these days.
I'll
flick him over.
Thank you for listening. Let us know if anything stood out for you during the chat. As the new pod on the block, it would be awesome if you look out for us and share this episode with someone that you think may be interested. While you're at it, why not head to our socials and share some love with a like, follow, or comment? Keep an eye out for the next pod drop. Big thanks to Stilo Media for producing this piece of art we call Sounding Board Parenting. From our hearts to yours, we hope you're making progress on something that you love and makes you feel alive. Remember, this can go anywhere.